from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. HBO may wrap up its hit series Sex and the City this season, but a new view of American demographics argues that for marriage-minded females, the show's just beginning. American women have blown past American men in educational attainment. Now something has to change. Millions of college women will marry no college men or not marry at all. Tonight on Point, marrying up, marrying down. But first, a wild card in the California recall saga. Today, a federal appeals court ruled the October 7th recall vote to decide the future of Governor Gray Davis cannot go forward as scheduled. If the ruling holds, the election could be delayed until March. Tim Grieve is senior writer for Salon.com and is keeping a close eye on developments in Sacramento. I asked him to describe the mood and reaction to the ruling in California.
Well, the chat is back. It's been an interesting day already in California. The Ninth Circuit, as you know, has postponed the October 7th election. Nobody knows how long that will last or when a new election might be held. But the circus that was a circus before is even more of a circus now.
The Ninth Circuit said they were concerned about a, quote, hurried, constitutionally infirm process. What exactly did they point to?
Well, the problem the Ninth Circuit identified is that six counties in California still use the old punch card voting method that was such a problem in the Florida recount.
Including Los Angeles.
Los Angeles, Sacramento, ironically, as the Ninth Circuit pointed out, the governor's own vote might not be counted if things don't go right with the voting machines. What the court said was that these voting machines are more prone to error than the other forms of balloting out there, and because of that, people in those six counties have a 2.5 times greater risk that their votes won't count, and that means that as many as 40,000 votes in this upcoming election wouldn't be counted, and that creates an equal protection problem under the United States Constitution.
So the hanging chad really is back as an issue. If the vote doesn't go ahead on October 7th, then where does it go?
That's a good question, and nobody seems to know the answer yet. I think most people think the most likely scenario is this case goes instantly to the Supreme Court, and either one justice acting alone, and that would be Sandra Day O'Connor, could issue a stay of this decision until after October 7th, thereby allowing the vote to go forward, or the whole court could get involved and reverse the Ninth Circuit. People seem pretty confident that the Supreme Court isn't going to let this stand.
So the Supreme Court is very accustomed to overruling the Ninth Circuit, the most liberal appellate court in the federal system.
That's right. Remember, this is the federal court that held that the under God language in the Pledge of Allegiance was unconstitutional.
So one Supreme Court justice can put a stay on this ruling and the election would go ahead. If that shouldn't happen, there's talk of it going until March when the recall question would share space on the ballot with California's presidential primary.
That's right, and that changes the political dynamic, one would think, rather dramatically. You suddenly have a race that Democrats are sort of holding their nose about. No one out here loves Gray Davis, and no one out here is very excited to vote for Cruz Bustamante. But you have that race all of a sudden sharing a ballot with the Democratic presidential primary, a subject on which a lot of Democrats would have a lot of excitement.
So presumably it would bring out a lot of Democratic voters and increase Gray Davis's chances of staying in office.
That's the thinking out here, coupled with the notion that, you know, giving it whatever it is to March, 4, 5, 6 months, time for people to calm down about Gray Davis, and maybe the economy turns around a little bit. Maybe there's more bad news about Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the picture gets better for Davis.
The ACLU brought this suit. Everybody knew it was being considered. Did people expect the Ninth Circuit to rule as they have today?
Well, they expected it as of about a week ago when the oral argument on the case was held. One of the judges asked whether the court was, you know, required to accept the unacceptable being the punch card ballot machine. So that was a pretty good sign that things were going in favor of the Davis camp.
Any comments today from the other very many contenders for the governor's seat in California?
I haven't heard from many of them, but the word out there, certainly from Davis, is we're going to plug ahead with the election. You never know what's going to happen. And I think everybody is taking the approach that, hey, this is the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit gets reversed a lot, and we're going to march ahead as if there's an election on October 7th until something higher than the Ninth Circuit tells us otherwise.
So may it march straight ahead. Who's leading in the polls right now?
Bustamante still seems to be ahead in the replacement candidate polls, although it's very, very close with Schwarzenegger just behind him. The question over the weekend was whether Tom McClintock, the more conservative Republican candidate, would drop out. If he does, the thinking is that Schwarzenegger surges ahead because he picks up McClintock's votes. McClintock so far says he's in it for the long haul, and that doesn't seem to be happening. On the first question on the ballot, that is, should Davis be recalled, that's getting ever closer. When this thing started, it seemed very likely Davis would be recalled. Now it's about 50-45, which is awfully close to the margin of error.
Schwarzenegger getting pretty racy today with Oprah. Do Californians seem to mind when he gets out of gubernatorial character?
Well, I haven't seen the Oprah bit today, but it's interesting. You know, Schwarzenegger did this interview in We magazine back in 1977 where he talked of smoking dope and group sex and all sorts of things, and he's distanced himself from that as sort of ancient history, and yet there are a lot of things Schwarzenegger has said over the last couple of years that were certainly racy, dismissive toward women, really just foul and obnoxious toward women, not saying that, you know, I have engaged in this particular allegedly inappropriate activity, but just speaking of women in really foul and degrading ways. And so far, that doesn't seem to have a lot of traction with voters.
Maria Shriver says he's all for women, and Bill Clinton has leaned in on behalf of Gray Davis. How's that being received? Is it a plus or not for the governor?
I think it's a plus here in California. Clinton is extremely popular in California. He's obviously extremely popular in the African-American community. They were together in Los Angeles at a predominantly African-American church. Clinton and Davis were this weekend, and Davis has not been hugely popular with African-Americans, but Clinton's help could help turn that around.
Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Tim Grieve is senior writer for Salon.com. He spoke with me from Sacramento, California. Sex and the City may have garnered Emmy Awards for Best Comedy, but the show, with its over-credentialed, under-married stars, may be closer to reality TV. If millions of women are feeling they can't find the right man anymore, says our guest tonight, they're right, at least by traditional expectations. American women have poured into college and advanced degrees in sharply greater numbers than men. They cannot all find equally educated husbands. That fact will now drive the realities of courtship, marriage, and family dynamics for years. Tonight on Point, marrying up, marrying down, and American women outpacing American men. Women, can you feel it? Is it getting tougher to meet your match, your peer in accomplishment for marriage? Is it time for she doctors to marry he plumbers and get over it? And if she's got the PhD, will he change the diapers? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Atlanta is Roderick Duncan, assistant professor of economics at Georgia Tech and author of the recent article in Challenge magazine, Does Sex and the City Predict the Future of Marriage? Good evening and welcome, Roderick Duncan.
Thank you very much, Tom. Thank you for inviting me on.
It's good to have you. Also on the line from Amherst, Massachusetts, is Barbara Defoe Whitehead, co-director of the National Marriage Project at Rutgers University and author of Why There Are No Good Men Left, The Romantic Plight of the New Single Woman. Good evening and welcome, Barbara Defoe Whitehead.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be with you.
It's great to have you both. Wow, the world is changing in ways that we hadn't even thought about. And you really perked up our ears here, not just for the challenge of people to figure out whom they will marry and what standard to bring to it, but for all the implications that may have for families and child rearing and everything else. You start out, Roderick Duncan, saying that modern culture, or lately people have been blaming the difficulty of finding husbands on modern culture, on modern psychology, on bad men, on bad women, on doting mothers, weak fathers, everything. You say, no, it's just demographics. It's just about how what male and female populations are doing.
Right. You'd expect an economist to say it's all about supply and demand.
Yes, you would.
And that's exactly what I end up saying, in fact, that there's an undersupply of well-educated women and undersupply of men.
And why is that? What's going on?
Well, women just have been far more successful in education in the last 20 years. Sometime around the mid-80s, women replaced men as the majority on campuses, and women have gotten more undergraduate degrees than men have, and that trend is continuing and getting worse.
Now, we'll look at those numbers, but what's the I was laughing at the definitions you've got here, but it's really economist definitions. People think about
right.
what a suitable marriage partner is, and there's all kinds of things we could say about that. But you bring a kind of economist's eye to it in what you've got here as corrected observation one. what's the kind of economic definition of how these levels of people in society meet and marry?
Right. Well, typically in the past, it's always been, and it still is today, that most people tend to marry someone who's of equal education as them. Education, in a sense, is like class in the U.S. We have no class, but we do have education. So people tend to marry people with equal levels of education as themselves.
And you go further than that in your observation here. You say that well-educated women marry men who are their equal or higher.
Right. In the past, there's always been more women than men get out of high school, but more men than women get out of college. So there's been so typically, if you look at the figures, women with high school degrees have tended to marry men who have equal or less education themselves. But for college-educated women, they've always had the pick of the loot.
So, and in fact, the better educated the woman, the more likely it is traditionally that she will marry up.
She will marry someone of equal education or higher than herself.
Now, how is that running into these numbers that you're describing of women and their educational accomplishment?
Right. Well, it's going to be hard when you have 10 million women graduating in a decade and only 8 million men. For all of these women to find mates that they would find of equal education as themselves.
Barbara Defoe Whitehead, what do you make of this? You've got the economist weighing in your ear on turf that you've paid a lot of attention to. You've looked at difficulties in courtship as a major reason that women have raised a hue and cry about the difficulty of finding a spouse. Roderick Duncan says fundamentally it's about numbers and social status.
Well, I think both are in play and roughly affecting the same pioneering generation of women. Professor Duncan is certainly right that we've had this historic reversal of male dominance in higher education. And what's equally remarkable is in how short a period of time it's been accomplished. And one of the, I think, unintended or unexpected consequences of that is that the traditional mating market mechanisms that used to be pretty effective in pairing people off, people of similar educational backgrounds off, don't work very effectively anymore because the college campus is no longer functioning as a marriage market.
And why not?
Well, because men and women are postponing marriage until older ages. In 1970, the median age of first marriage for women overall was 21, and for men it was 23. Today, it's reached the oldest age in a century. It's 25 for women and close to 27 for men. And that's for all men and women. For college-educated men and women, estimates are that it's probably a year or two later than that. So by the time people are beginning to seriously contemplate searching for a marriage mate, they aren't looking on a college campus where you tended to have sort of a dense population of similarly matched men and women, mm-hmm. with women having the sex ratio advantage. Mm-hmm. Instead, people are dispersed across the entire landscape. They're out working all day. It's just much harder to find someone to be your soulmate.
But Roderick Duncan is saying that even if you had today, even if you had a perfectly efficient marriage market, you'd still have over a decade something like 2 million women who would not find an equally educated male partner.
Well, I mean, that's especially true for African-American women, and I think Professor Duncan makes that point very well in his paper. There is a study from Princeton researchers that say that for white, well-educated women, the problem is more likely to be a delay of marriage until older ages rather than a complete defeat of marriage chances, partly because in addition to marrying down the educational ladder, some women are marrying out. That is, they're looking in a much broader marriage market, a global marriage market. Mm. And also, some are marrying what is known as second-round guys. Divorced men with similar educational background come back into the marriage market. So it's a very dynamic kind of marriage market. So it may be possible. It's just very long and hard to find a suitable marriage mate.
Well, it's a whole new world out there. Barbara Defoe Whitehead, Roderick Duncan, stand by. We're looking tonight at the apparent future for many American women marrying down, women outstripping men in achievement. So who are they going to marry? Women, is it getting tougher to meet your match, your peer in achievement? for marriage? And if women are graduating from college in such greater numbers than men, is it now okay for women to marry down? Does marry down make sense anymore? This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the apparent future for American women marrying down. Women are outstripping men in achievement. So who are they going to marry? How will courtship and marriage change when women are on the faster track? Should we stop talking about marrying down? Does it really matter who's got the degrees? Can she doctors marry he plumbers? Or is that a recipe for discord? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight from Amherst, Massachusetts, Barbara Defoe Whitehead, co-director of the American Marriage Project. And from Atlanta, Georgia, Roderick Duncan, assistant professor of economics at Georgia Tech and author of the new article, Does Sex in the City Predict the Future of Marriage? Roderick Duncan, you say here that because of the numbers, because you have and will continue to have millions of women more educated than the comparably educated men, that social assumptions about the status of men and women within a marriage will have to change. What do you mean by that?
Well, remember, this is really the story about well-educated or elite women. This is not the story about high school educated or high school dropouts. And Ms. Whitehead's book is the same. It's really the story of what's going on with well-educated women. And with well-educated women, there's always been a lot more rich, well-educated men than there were rich, educated women. So it was quite easy to find a mate who was of equal status or higher. But the situation is reversed when those mates become scarcer.
So when the highly educated male married the librarian, the
right.
nurse,
so,
the
so
secretary, no, that was within the bounds of what society said, okay, we understand that.
You go to the Rotary Club, and there's a husband there who's the doctor and his wife the librarian, and you can introduce her around, and that's not a problem. But if you imagine a Vassar girl showing up at a Vassar 20th graduation reunion, and there's her boyfriend, the bartender, and she's the partner at a law firm, that can be a little harder to explain.
But that, you're saying, is where things are headed. You're right, the marriage between the doctor and her husband, the bartender, will become more common than the marriage between the lawyer and his wife, the postal worker.
Right. Well, the numbers simply say that that's going to have to be one implication of it, yes.
What implications, first of all, that has all kinds of implications for simply finding a mate, but what about within households? How do you see this playing out?
Well, I mean, you can already see it, and I already know with friends of mine that it's a bit of a stress when, in fact, the woman is a primary earner. And then questions come down to who's going to sacrifice their career if one of the two partners' jobs require a move. If she's the one bringing in more money, then he may be the one who's going to have to sacrifice his career to get hers on track.
And do you see that happening already?
Well, not amongst my friends, but I think that is going to have to be the case.
Barbara mentioned the African-American population and what's already been evident there. You've got some numbers about that. What's the story there, and what does it tell us?
Well, the story there is actually pretty tragic. If you have a look at black female marriage patterns, in the mid-70s, they were the same as white females. But if you look nowadays, almost a quarter of black females aged 35 to 54 are unmarried. In fact, have never married, and at that point are probably quite unlikely ever to marry. So that suggests that, in fact, it's not simply a matter of marrying out or marrying up or marrying anywhere. It's simply not being married at all.
And are you saying that this is in the future for some considerable number of non-African-American women?
Right. Well, picture if, say, one quarter of white women were unmarried.
Are the numbers that drastic?
No. The numbers now are less than 10%.
But the trend line
is the trend. Well, the question is either you're either going to have to marry down or you're going to have to not marry. And you know the options such as marrying out are quite limited.
Barbara Defoe Whitehead, how do you think? How are American women handling that challenge, and how do you think this is likely to evolve?
Well, I think a couple of things. First of all, I do agree that there will be shifting of expectations about marriage itself and the respective roles that each partner plays. I think well-educated women very much expect to have a partner who, they tell me, stands on his own two feet. holds a reasonably good job, is dedicated to his career, but also is emotionally literate. In a recent Gallup survey of 20-something men and women, 80% of the women said that they would rather have a spouse who could talk about his deepest feelings than a spouse who was a good breadwinner. So, I mean, this historically is not what men have been prepared to do with respect to marriage.
But so, when we look at status, what does it suggest? Does a college degree make that emotional literacy any more likely, or are women just as likely to find that, you know, in a plumber with a big view of the world? Is this potentially the bridge between, you know, the degree-holding woman and the non-degree-holding man? Here's a guy with great emotional range.
It could very well be that that is what women find attractive, and that it will be one of the reasons that they begin increasingly to perhaps marry down or not to consider educational attainment as the one most important measure of status, of economic success, and of you know, shared standing in the community. So I do think it will have an impact on traditional norms of marriage.
Big change coming, though, around the Thanksgiving dinner table, talking about who's going to be married. A lot of callers want to join the conversation, and I want to invite them in. Annie's calling from Boston. Hi, Annie. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I am, I'm both heartened and dismayed by what I hear tonight.
Okay.
I think that what your speakers are basically relaying is what I've been experiencing and, you know, everything that I've been seeing. And so that's somewhat encouraging. But on the other hand, I just feel that this is something that is definitely going to be a change for women. And as an African-American woman here in Boston, I have just felt like I've been turning left and right trying to meet people, and it just has not been working. And although I'm willing to date outside my race, it just it's just not there.
So your personal experience then, sort of, you found the same thing. You're looking for a man of a certain accomplishment or equal to your own, and you're not finding that?
Right. And I tried to date down, as you term it, and I found that to be, in my limited experience, I found it to be unsatisfying and unfulfilling. And then I thought, well, perhaps, you know, maybe the educational issue was what I needed, and perhaps if I had someone who, you know, was also similarly situated, we would be able to partake in the same activities, mm-hmm. and you know, have lots of common experiences, and I wouldn't be as dissatisfied as I was before. And so that's where I tried to focus my efforts, and it's tough, you know, and it's so tough here in Boston that I've actually considered relocating and thinking that, you know, well, maybe they can tell me where in the country, other than Alaska,
right.
Where the men are, I don't know.
Well, that's a good question. Let us pick that one up and stick with us for a minute, Annie. Roderick Duncan, what about Annie raises just the geographical question. If she's found herself in a spot where that she's drilling and there's no oil, is there some place where the ratios are better?
Well, unfortunately, I don't have very much good news for her. I mean, there are just as many men as there are women out there. It's just that the men that she's looking for are rarer. And there's 3 college-educated black women for every 2 college-educated black men, which means it's great for the marriage market to be a black, well-educated male, but it's not very good at all to be a black, well-educated female.
Annie, it looks like a tough road to hoe. What's your next step?
Well, I think... I think I will look around the country and see where things might be a little bit better, and I will continue to meet as many men as I can.
We wish you good luck with that. Thanks a lot for calling, Annie. Mary's calling from Warwick, Rhode Island. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm really rather intrigued by the discussion tonight. I have to disagree with a gentleman who spoke initially, who said that we don't have class structure in the United States. We have educated people and not educated people. I have to disagree. The class, no matter where, you know, you talk about class structure, it has always been based on the haves and the have-nots. And education has figured into it. It's part of status. And it I have to admit, it really bothers me. When I hear this discussion, I mean, some of the people who will call in, no doubt, several generations back, they had very undereducated, very blue-collar relatives, and the discussion in this sort of medium back then would have been the fact that it's discriminatory and the need to access. And I really wish we would have more discussions about the ability to access higher education than having this population of haves really focusing on their needs rather than on the have-nots.
Well, we're trying to look at the whole question, and there have been many nights when we've talked right here about the access to education. But I sit here with the same concern, Mary, when we are saying marrying up and marrying down. There's a judgment in that, and yet you know very well, everybody knows what that means, what it suggests. I mean, are you saying that society can, should, might one day not think in terms of up or down?
I would hope that one day we would, you know, base our value judgments on things other than that. But I don't know, just from listening to the discussions, whether it's on having children later in life or what have you, they always seem to be these sort of value judgments. And you can tell there is a clear class structure in the United States ever since the 80s. I mean, people seem to leap towards it as though they have this chip on their shoulder that they're afraid someone might know of their blue-collar roots.
And yeah.
It bothers me. I have to be honest about that. Thank you.
I hear you. Thanks for calling. Roderick Duncan, first to you. Mary says, hey, you say there's not class. I'm not sure that's exactly what you said, but that education is the marker for class. She says, well, it's just class flat out. And how do you respond?
Well, I think here it still is the matter that education is a sense, stands for class here. Every person above a certain income threshold, their children would be expected to go to college. And it almost would be a surprise if someone who is a millionaire, their child did not. Whereas if you say take England, where you really do have class, then you are either born into a certain family or you aren't.
I mean, you're saying you have kind of hereditary standing in society, an
right.
aristocracy or the remnants of it.
America essentially class is money. And if you're wealthy enough, you can buy a certain level of status or social standing.
Barbara Defoe-Whitehead, what about the mobility between class tiers in the United States, however you define it, by education, by money, and as Roderick says, it's often by both. You know, Mary's saying, look, I'm uncomfortable with all this tiering, and she's not entirely sympathetic when those women who had more money, went to college, can't find somebody just in their same tier. Well, get over it. There's the rest of the country to look to.
Well, one other thing that we haven't talked too much about is that conceptions of marriage have changed as well, and that influences people's attitudes toward marriage and this whole debate about marrying up and marrying down. It used to be that marriage was sort of a big institution with a bundle of things it provided to individuals. And one of the things for women was that by marrying, they could enhance their economic status and overall. And it also had to do with bringing together families of similar religious beliefs. It had to do with, regional differences. And today, marriage has really become almost entirely an emotional relationship between two individuals, losing many of those institutional features. And I think that puts a premium very much on the problem or contributes to the problem we're discussing, that women are looking for a soulmate. They're looking for someone with whom they can feel this deep emotional connection. And they tend to be able to find that most comfortably, or so they think, with men of similar educational aspirations and background. Even though empirically that may not be true, and we may be running a great experiment to find out where the sensitive guys are who don't have college degrees.
Well, it'll certainly put the pressure on women to consider alternatives. Rob's calling from Racine, Wisconsin. Hi, Rob. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd just like to make a comment that I'm dating my prom date from high school, which is, 8 years ago.
Okay.
And, both went our own ways after high school. I stayed in town. I went to the technical college, got a two-year degree, and she went off to school and then got a master's as a physical therapist. And then she moved back to town, and, we were both single at the time and been going out. And Well, this conversation's pretty interesting because it makes me wonder, well, I don't know, is there something I got to measure up to? But I just think it's, you know.
So she's got the big degree, you've got the 2-year degree, and it's not making any difference in your relationship.
Not really. I mean, I'm doing pretty good financially, so that probably helps, but I kind of wonder that myself. Well, do I need a bachelor's or more?
Well, I mean, we want to encourage, I guess, everybody to step up here, not worry about the rest. But Roderick Duncan, how about it? Maybe Rob is the new way here. You know, yeah, she's got the bigger degree, but they've got the relationship, and it's fine, thank you, says Rob.
Well, but notice Rob stressed the fact that he was making money, which in America we know by status. So I guess in a sense he's regarding that as compensating for the degree.
And he's probably right.
But I guess, you know, what interests me is still the fact that underneath this he is quite uneasy.
Well, or at least he is now. Sorry if we put you.
I guess I'd be more interested in knowing whether he was uneasy before the program.
Rob, has it ever come up in your relationship?
She's comfortable with it because I've always joked about it. You know, oh, maybe you should have married a doctor when she started working at the hospital. It's like, oh, they're just too into themselves, you know. So
maybe you've got what she's looking for, and that's great, Rob. Thanks very much for calling. Roderick Duncan, you're looking here also at the shift into the household and household roles when these relationships do get firmed up, and you're saying that may have to change too, or employers may have to change in how they treat women.
Right. Well, traditionally it's been the matter that, a male's big push in a career is in the 30s, and the female typically sacrifices her career to make that go ahead. And the question then arises, what happens when it's the female's need to make a career push? Will the male sacrifice his career to allow that to happen? And two, how will this work with child rearing and childbirth? How is a woman going to make a big career push if she would like to plan to have 2 children sometime in her 30s?
So it was given the social structure that we're all accustomed to, it was a lot simpler when more men got degrees. What's happened in education? Why have men fallen behind, Roderick Duncan?
Well, no, actually, that's the big puzzle. No one really knows that.
I'd like to
There's
say
a big debate
something.
About that right now.
Yeah, Barbara, we just got 20 seconds.
I'd like
seconds,
to but say, I mean, I do think that there has been a huge social investment over the past 25 and 30 years in boosting women's levels of educational attainment and achievement. And it's been a vastly successful project that has, I think, ended up with what we have now, which is this remarkable climb of women into dominance in higher education. But it wasn't accidental. I mean, we had a variety of legislative initiatives, social movements, and personal decisions by parents to resist the sort of second-class citizenship of young girls.
And now we've got the fruit of that. We're looking at it tonight. Women, is it getting tougher to meet your match? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the apparent future for many American women, that is, marrying down. Women are outstripping men in educational achievement. So who are they going to marry? If women are graduating from college in such greater numbers than men, is it now okay for women to marry down? And what are women's choices here? To keep looking for the man who doesn't exist or to change life plans? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are Barbara Defoe Whitehead, joining us from Amherst, Massachusetts. She's the author of Why There Are No Good Men Left, The Romantic Plight of the New Single Woman, and co-director of the American Marriage Project. And from Atlanta, Georgia, Roderick Duncan, assistant professor of economics at Georgia Tech, and author of the article, Does Sex and the City Predict the Future of Marriage? You can join the conversation as well, 1-800-423-8255. Roderick Duncan, you put the big question out there. You say the bottom line, decade between 88 and 98 produced 8 million males with university degrees and higher and 10 million females with university degrees and higher. You say these numbers are likely to grow even more disproportionate in the future. Who will all these women marry, if they even do? And what changes will occur in a society where educated women greatly outnumber educated men? What changes do you think that portends, Roderick Duncan?
Well, I think it's going to have to involve child rearing, and that is going to be the big choices that future couples will have to make. Who is going to have to bear the brunt of rearing children? Obviously, we won't be able to change, in a sense, who it is will be bearing the children, but we can at least change who it is that is staying home and raising them.
Do you think it will change the percentage of women who marry at all?
Well, if you look in the black community, that, in fact, seems to be true. It seems to be one of the responses is simply never to marry. If I can't find a good man, I don't want any of them.
And off it goes. Julianne's calling from Malden, Massachusetts. Hi, Julianne. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm 45, and I can read the demographics. And so when I went looking for my second marriage, I know this is not an option for everybody, but I'm about to form a partnership with a woman my age. She's got the same kind of career or a little better. She's got the emotional fluency, and she's a soulmate. So I know that's not an option for everybody, but there are a lot of great women out there, as you're discussing. I just wanted to throw that out.
So you're saying, hey, who needs men?
Well, again, that's not an option for everybody,
right?
But I'm very happy.
Wow. Well, was it because of the market, Julianne, or was it because of something you found inside yourself? I mean, you're talking about a lesbian relationship as opposed to a heterosexual relationship. And so do you think that was market-driven? We've got an economist on here tonight, or driven by your somehow personal choice inside?
Well, I have been married to a man very happily. I consider myself bisexual. But when I got to midlife, had my midlife crisis and looked around, it was kind of market-driven, actually. I mean, it's I didn't really even consider guys because my girlfriends had been complaining for years about how hard it was to meet good ones, and I thought, okay, well, let's go the other way.
Go where the options are. Julianne, thanks for your call. Barbara Defoe Whitehead, how about it?
Well, I guess bisexual people do have more choices than those who are seeking just opposite-sex partners. But
part of what people are looking for is simply... a partner that they can fully share with at some level. And our caller's saying she looked around, she couldn't find the men, and so here was an option.
Well, you know, I do think that some women, we didn't mention this, but in addition to just opting not to be married, some women will have children on their own and very often form partnerships, household arrangements with a cohabiting partner or with family members. So there will be a variety of arrangements even beyond marriage that people will adopt in order to achieve some of the things that once were traditionally considered part of the marriage arrangement.
The economist number is driving all kinds of change here. Jennifer's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi. I was calling because I was sort of thinking of what the previous caller had said, that maybe higher education just gives women more opportunity to make a lot of other decisions, choosing either not to marry or, as your guest said, choosing to have children on their own, choosing to have a partner who is also a woman, since more women now can get better paying jobs. It's no longer the economic road to something else. Marriage, it can be so many other things. It doesn't have to just be about the money or the education or the resources. And many women probably do prefer to either be alone or to have other sorts of relationships where they still have their own single identity. And it seems to be misleading to be saying that how you've discussed this, it sort of implies that all women want to be married, and that may not be the case.
Yeah, absolutely. We hear that. But I wonder, Jennifer, how you think about that, because Roderick Duncan is not saying that there aren't about an equal number of men out there. In fact, there are. He's simply saying that they don't have the same degrees as women. So,
so it means more women are getting degrees, so more women are having the option to get the trophy husband rather than the rich man getting the trophy wife. That women have the choice to delay marriage, to women have the choice to be single people who decide to travel or do things that you can't is easily do.
But what about the choice just to say, hey, how important is the degree? I want a companion, and if I'm heterosexual, I want a man. I don't really care if he's got a college degree. If he's a great carpenter, I'm for the carpenter.
If men have been able to make this decision for so long, why can't women? I do understand what the caller who complained about the class issue was getting at, but I can also see that. Personally, I often find it easier to interact with people with comparable education levels to myself, but that's sort of a gross generalization, and it has to do as much with sort of almost tribal identity that these are the people like you. People tend to like other people like them. But
and maybe at a certain point, if women have enough success under their belts, I guess, they'll feel that same confidence to marry whoever they like, whatever the social standing. But we've got it, Jennifer, and thank you for your call. One more call here. Joe's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say, this is actually a great opportunity for guys like me. I'm college educated, about to be a lawyer, and I'm looking at a buyer's market.
So everyone's wringing their hands, and you're saying, hey, opportunity knocks.
Hey, exactly. I just wanted to drop that comment.
Okay, Joe, we got it, and good luck out there. Robert Duncan, I guess in many respects, what you're pointing is that Joe's right. He's going to have there's a lot of buyers.
Right, and I guess then the question becomes, why should Joe bother to marry? If he's got a buyer's market out there, why should he, in a sense, tie himself down?
Why do you even raise that? Is that are you seeing that happen? That men have so many options.
You're actually seeing that happen with well-educated black males.
They have so many potential partners that the advantages of marriage aren't clear to them.
Perhaps that's the case because they're not marrying either.
Wow! Yet another change that may come out of this matrix. Barbara Defoe Whitehead, what about the idea of women reaching a comfort level with their new accomplishments? Where they're just as comfortable as men were for the longest time in saying, hey, I can marry someone of a different social standing if they appeal to me, and that's all that's required, and I don't care what anyone thinks.
Oh, I think that's already happening to the degree that women can find those men and mate with them. I don't think what drives women in marriage anymore is exclusively, trying to boost their level of social standing. They're very comfortable with their own accomplishments. And in fact, there's never been a better time in American history to be a single woman. So women have many more options too, and I think some of them will feel quite confident marrying someone of lesser educational attainment. It, after all, will not pose the same intense conflict that many two-career couples face. If there's one sort of career primary person and one career secondary person in a household.
Wow, big world just keeps on changing. It is amazing. Barbara Defoe Whitehead, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Barbara Defoe Whitehead is co-director of the American Marriage Project and author of Why There Are No Good Men Left. And Roderick Duncan, thanks so much for your work and your piece and being with us tonight.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Roderick Duncan, assistant professor of economics at Georgia Tech. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. This is On Point. When Pittsburgh writer Brian Conley looks at his daughter, he sees someone on the opposite side of the political spectrum. In this radio diary, he reflects on his own ever-increasing conservatism and his daughter's effortless liberalism.
My daughter has become a tree-hugging, kumbaya-singing liberal. Everybody, she thinks, wants a kiss and a flower. She enthusiastically embraces ethnic, cultural, and gender diversity in her friendships. Selfish people baffle her, and she could never support anything as violent as the invasion of Iraq. She hates it when people or animals are scared. She would certainly attend a gay wedding, especially if they had balloons. She's 2.5 years old. Winston Churchill said a person who is not liberal when young has no heart, so my toddler is obviously far to the left. She has no agenda and belongs to no organization. I guess you could call her an anarchist. Unfortunately, Churchill also said a person should be conservative when old. An old daddy is growing more conservative by the day. When I look around my daughter and think about her future, it is not the vast majority of kind and sensible people that I see, but cowardly politicians, bad parents, rude children, fast drivers, and people with pit bulls. Any notions of understanding or reforming these people are gone. They're menaces. I watch them warily at the borders of my daughter's happy world. These people are really just nuisances, but people driven by real evil reached out for our happy world. My daughter was born about 6 months before September 11th, 2001. I was home with her on my lap all through that Tuesday, watching all that death on television, waiting for my wife to come home. My daughter's presence and unawareness were my comfort. It's become a bit of a joke to say that September 11th changed America. If the Osbournes and college football go on, we ask, what's changed? But I know that I've changed. I flatter myself that the relationship with my daughter contains a metaphor for the war on terror. When military guys would say that they fight a war to protect people's right to protest the war, I used to be skeptical. Now the idea makes sense. The world seemed to love us under Clinton. At least, they love Clinton. Under Bush, the world seems to hate us. At least, they hate Bush. It will probably be a long time before America seems popular again. I'm certainly less popular now that I'm a father. I'm less tolerant, I'm less easygoing. I have less time for people. For now, probably for a long time, there is one thing in the world that matters very much to me. The rest of the world has to matter less. It makes me sad sometimes. I've always prided myself on being good company. Ebenezer Scrooge's great sin was not sending his spirit abroad in the world, and I know Dickens was right. It is a sin. 2 years ago, I was a better person. A quote sticks with me from historian Barbara Tuchman's book, The Proud Tower, about the years leading up to World War I. Belgian socialist poet Emile Verhaeren, soon to die at the front, looked back at life before 1914 and dedicated his last book, with emotion, to the man I used to be. Someday I hope to be back in the world as the man I used to be. For now, my daughter put so much love into that world that it more than makes up for my absence. I'm content to play the guard dog for her life and her spirit. The more conservative me, I tell myself, helps my liberal daughter stay that way for as long as she can. Her generous soul is my heart and my hope. I don't root for the conservative me or the conservatives prosecuting the war on terror. Like the war, we are grim facts. The very best part of us as a country and the very best part of me lies elsewhere. When the smoke clears, I hope that we can still find those best parts.
Brian Conley is a writer and editor. He lives in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, with his wife and 2.5-year-old daughter, Sophia. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.